Hello and welcome again to Oscar Mike Radio. My name is Travis, Marine Corps veteran and your host. Oscar Mike Radio is co-produced with Sinister One Productions. What's your podcast doing? I want to thank my sponsors, Joyce Asak of Asak Real Estate, Echo 6 Ranch, and my supporters, Kason Shaving Company, Exceptional Parent Magazine, and Fight Camp. Be your strongest combination. As we count down to 500, we're starting off Veterans Day with a very special guest. And coincidentally, this guest is not American. He did not serve in the American military, but a veteran nonetheless. I want to welcome my good friend and Ukrainian, Vladislav Shapiro, Vlad as we call him, to Oscar Mike Radio. Vlad, welcome. How are you doing?
Thank you very much, Travis. It's always nice to be on your show, and huge to every veteran of the United States around. We have a lot of respect, and thank you for servicing the country. Thank you very much.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's all good with you and what you're trying to do for Ukrainian veterans and Ukrainian people. Before we get into all that good stuff, kind of give me a sense of who Vlad is. You grew up in the Ukraine, you served in the Ukraine military. What was all that like, Vlad?
Well, thank you for asking. I am the Ukrainian Jewish person who was born in Kyiv in 1967. Hard to believe how long was that. When I was serving, I was a mathematician by education, and at that time, because of the war in Afghanistan, even if you are in the university, you still have to serve. So I served for 2 years, and it was service not in the Ukrainian, but it was the Soviet Army. It was, yeah, very different from as you can expect. And I was lucky enough to have good parents and grandparents who helped me out to understand that when you go to the military, you have to have a specialty in the military, which makes sense for them. So even though I'm a mathematician, I became a movie projectionist. So
Wait a
when I
minute. The
was, yes.
Soviet Army, the UK has that was the actual military job.
Yes.
Okay.
It was a military job of showing the movies and also taking care of the space, which was like a theater, like a club, the soldiers' club, whatever you want to call it. When we have not only movies but also, performances and some other activities, and definitely because it was a Soviet time, the political activities too. So I was lucky enough to actually ended up in city of Dnipro, which is not that far from Kyiv, and spent 2 years of meeting people I've never met in my life otherwise. It was very interesting and strange time in the Soviet, in the history, not only the Soviet Union, but also the world, because the Afghan war was almost over. The Soviet regime was changing because of Gorbachev, and the whole military thing was changing too. So I was a witness of the famous Rus landing in Red Square. It was exactly when I was in the military, and I was a witness how everything was changing in like in the minute after what happened. And most of my military service, I was in a division which is supposed to be responsible for construction, mostly housings, and sometimes construction around like airdrome and like Air Force areas, the areas of other military locations. But my job was entertaining people and helping make sure that everybody is coming, when they come back to the quarters, they have something to do, not malicious, like
Okay.
watching the movies. That was basically, that was a story. But again, I was very lucky because unfortunately at that time, anti-Semitism was pretty big in the country, and I was lucky that I was in Ukraine, because if I go to somewhere else as a Jewish person, mathematician, I would have issues. And some of my friends who did, they had a lot of problems. So that's the story.
What was the Soviet military like? Because you mentioned Gorbachev and some of those things, and that's to your point when Russia started really changing. And as the end of their Afghan war, what was it like being in the military, in terms of, how you were expected to carry yourself, being able to, grow in the military. And, people here don't understand that in certain parts of the world, military service is mandatory, no questions asked. What was all that like, Vlad?
Well, it was kind of horrible on one side because you don't know what you're going to happen when you are in college. When you're 18 years old, you're going to be mandatory serving. You don't know where, you don't know how, you don't know what capacity. even though it kind of theoretically look at you, and yes, if you are, sports guy or you are seriously into the very military stuff, so chances are you're going to become, a Blue Beret, or you're going to go to the some serious troubles and serious places. For most of us, the military was the place you must spend 2 years. And what you're going to do there was not really a concern of the big military leaders, because military in the Soviet Union was basically a free, labor. That was it. And only a small part of it was actual military. Yes, we had actual military, true. We have, as you understand, nuclear weapons has to be served by someone. But there were what we call officers. To become a serious, in the military, you have to go through the military academy. And there were two levels of them. One of them is for the officers, and another one is for the higher officers. Like if you want to become a major, colonel or general, then you have to go to a complete level. So a lot of officers came from regular universities or from the military schools, right? So, but every conscript, oh, that's free labor. That's, people who are supposed to do something, except of very technical specialties. For example, if you're anti, missile place, or like you are in the Navy or any other places where you really need to learn technology, or that was important. For most of us, it was just almost, you're 2 years in, I can't call it prison, but kind of. So that was basically the story. This is why, unfortunately, in like construction divisions, you can imagine, all the officers were not exactly the most brilliant ones, let's call it this way. And a lot of them have issues with discipline and everything else. And another thing is what was unfortunately true for a lot of the Soviet army is corruption on a huge level. And everybody, if you have a chance, like in the military, you have a like in military construction, you have a chance to touch, I don't know, bricks or any materials. Like, guess what? All of them were stolen and sold to the locals, in exchange for money, alcohol, food, or anything like that. Why? Because there was no control. And again, for American audience, you have to understand that is 90% of the military, but 10% was real. That's my experience.
Unreal, because I guess if you are conscripted and you're just there for 2 years, it doesn't really matter because there's somebody else 2 years later coming right after you.
Exactly.
So you serve in the, did you just do 2 years and get out of the military? What's that
Yes.
like getting out of the Soviet military?
Well, it was very interesting when of getting out, because when I was starting, it was, you have to understand, when you get closer to the end, officers and some other political, because in every military part of the Soviet Union, we had the like they called Zampolit, which is the deputy for political, basically indoctrination, what we call it today, right? So because I had an education, because we're pretty smart, then the people say, hey, would you like to continue to be in the army? Because you don't need to be in the Royal Army, you can start making money. I'm like, making money? So like, yeah, we're selling small stuff, but you can sell bigger stuff. I was like, really? There was a lot of interesting stories, but a lot of people are recruited towards the Communist Party's land, because if you become a communist in the army, and by the way, in the army, become the communist was much easier than outside. If you become a communist, a member of Communist Party, then you had a chance to build a career. Even on the civil side. So every director of the factory or CEO, right? Every vice president of the factory or any kind of institution, they were all members of Communist Party. You would not be able to even get there. So for some people, army would be like a stepping stone to get into the things later. By the way, a lot of current leaders of Russia came from the military.
So you just did 2 years.
Yes.
And what happened when you got out?
I continue my education, because university must keep space for me. As soon as I get out, I have to go back. And by the way, every university in the Soviet Union had the military education. So all of us, in addition to being mathematicians, we also had a military specialty, I would say. In
So
our case, it was anti-air carrier stuff. Yeah.
You got out of high school, you went into the military, and then the university had to take you when you got out.
It was worse. I went to university, spent 2 years there, got out of the university for 2 years, and then to have come back and continue my studying.
So but they had to take you back. It wasn't like an option.
Yes, they must. They must take me back.
And did they pay for your education? Did you have to pay for
In Soviet Union, education was free. You pay absolutely nothing.
Doesn't sound free, Vlad. Doesn't sound free at all.
Oh, it considered free. I mean, remember, if you look at the standard economy and economical system created by Soviets, it's like different planets. Very, 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 very different. Let's call it this way.
Okay. So you go to school, go to the military, go back to school, and then you start your life.
That's correct.
Yeah. So you've done all that over there in the Ukraine area. What brought you then to the United States?
Well, in 1991, I was admitted as a graduate student to the Brandeis University math department.
Okay.
So at the end of 90s, all of us had a chance to apply to American universities, and American universities, thank God, had the special money allocated for smart people coming from other countries to become PhDs, master degrees in specialties specifically needed for American economy, like mathematics, like computer science, like physics and chemistry. So I was able to get in as a graduate student in 1991, Brandeis. So from 1991, I spent most of my time in Boston area.
Okay. And did you bring your wife over? Did you meet your wife here? How
Oh,
all that was?
well, it's a strong story, long story, because yes, I brought my wife, unfortunately not my ex-wife now, and
Okay,
yes,
well.
and she's and my son, they're still here, yeah.
Oh, so you
But
started a family here. You had a family here,
yes.
you did all that. What was it like coming to America after being in the Soviet Union for so long?
You know what? It's so interesting because we had in 1991, I came exactly a day before the coup.
Okay.
Like the day before the coup, I have relatives in New York. I have a cousin of mine who lives in New York, still lives in New York. And we came, and my wife was pregnant, and we came to her house. And next day, we tried to call back home, and like, you can't call. And we called AT&T, but I was like, can we call? And they like, turn on the TV, turn on CNN. So that was kind of a shocking experience. But what really, and then, we had a very idealistic image of the United States, which was built usually by music, theater, movies, and kind of and genes, like a classical story, right? The good genes. So, and when they came to the United States, I thought I'm coming to, New York, right? All the beautiful skyscrapers, things like, and then I'm in Waltham, Massachusetts, right? Yeah, you're laughing. I was like, what is this? And you look around and say, that's America? That's educate. This is the country we were thinking about? Like when you walk on the streets, like Kiev streets are cleaner. We have more culture in a suburb of where I live in Kiev than in most of the places. And even you go to Boston, compare, like Boston has humongous amount of universities, right? For example. But amount of theaters in Kiev and Boston is incomparable. Kiev, even in the Kiev, even in the time of end of 80s, beginning of 90s, had more than 20 theaters in the city. I'm talking about professional theaters, not gigs, right? And when I came to Boston, I was like, what's going on here? Like, but the biggest surprise was definitely food.
Really?
Get used to taste of American food took me a long time. Yeah, because
In what
we
way?
Well, chemicals. Remember, I came in 1991, right? You go to the supermarket, yes, you can buy, one yogurt for 10 cents. And only later I realized how much different chemical elements are, because in the United States, especially at the 90s, the amount of chemicals allowed in food was crazy. It creates a fantastic looking taste, but it doesn't fit really well. Also, we used to smell different, like, for example, vegetables and fruits and berries smell very differently in Ukraine than it smell in America. It had no smell at all at that time. Plus, then you're trying to get to some kind of a European food because that's what you're used to more, right? But it's so expensive, and then the student stipend, you can't afford it, right?
Yeah.
So that was an interesting, but This is a very hard. But another thing which was very hard to used to, we lived in the country with more or less a homogeneous population. In the United States, you come and you see people from all around the world, especially when it comes to Boston and university areas, and culture, traditions, the way people look, the way people walk, the way people talk is very, very different from Ukraine. And it took some time. But what definitely huge positive thing I immediately saw is that people did not judge me in Ukraine, in the Soviet Union. You judged by, who you come from, what nationality are you. In the United States, I came and people said, well, even if you're an immigrant and you are a student, your possibilities are tremendous because you're a mathematician. That's the people who respect for the brain, for ability to think, analyze. And I realized from basically, first couple of months that the opportunities in America are incomparable with opportunities professionally. And, my life in America proved that.
You've built this life in America, and then this war in Ukraine happens. And I think the first question a lot of Americans have is, why did Putin do this, and what is it about Ukraine that he wants so much? A war that's supposed to be over in less than 2 weeks is now, almost going into year four. What is driving all of this?
Well, unfortunately, the number one reason why the war happened is because Russia is the last land empire. And the land empires who still have this idea that everything what they had before, they still have to have it. Putin said 1991 was the biggest tragedy in history of the Russian Empire, whatever you're going to call it, Russian Republic or the Soviet Union. For him, Ukraine does not exist as a separate country. For him, Ukraine is Russia. That kind of opinion, I would say, kind of view existed for a long time, was built. And the reason why Ukraine is so important for Russia is not economy, it's not bread, it's history. Because if you think about it, the original start of the Slavic state was Kyiv. Well, for that, I strongly recommend if somebody wants to listen to the history, I strongly recommend Timothy Snyder's series of lectures called Modern Ukraine. You can find them on YouTube. He is one of the best historian about knowing about Ukraine, and he is consulting the State Department, he's consulting military, he's consulting everybody for a long time. And he explained it a very great way of saying, well, it was, Kiev, Russia. There was Kiev, Rus, that was the name of the state. Then some of the territories captured by Golden Horde became what we knew as Muscovite Tsarstvo. And only in 17th century, the Muscovite Tsarstvo decided to grab all of the lands around, which earlier belonged to the Kiev Rus, and only Peter the Great renamed the state from Muscovite Tsarstvo to Российская империя, which is Russian Empire. Why did he do that? Because he wanted to keep the name and like a chain of events and say that we are the ancestors of the Kiev Rus, not Ukraine. Since Ukraine at that time was a part of that empire, it was hard to work on it. But in 1918, Ukraine became independent as a country, which was immediately squashed by the Soviet. At that time, it was no Soviet Union. The Moscow itself, right? Russia.
Right.
They had an army, and that army squashed Ukrainian independent. And the Ukrainians were screaming for help around the world. You can look at the nonsense protocols. You can look at the protocols of 1921, 22, 23, discussion around Ukraine. But the world just said, well, what's Ukraine? It doesn't really matter for us. Ukrainians had fighted the invasion. Actually, the creation of Soviet Union was an invasion of Ukraine. They were fighting it for generations. For us, the war was the question of like when it's going to happen, right? Because we knew that without Ukraine, Russian Empire loses the soul, it loses the history. And that's why they need to keep it. Okay. Russification, which means pushing Ukrainian language away, pushing Ukrainian culture away, and substituting with Russian, is not something new. I don't know if America knows, but there are more than 150 nations live on the territory of Russian Republic today, of Russian Federation. All of
So
them have,
that leads me to one question here. I mean, Ukraine is being under attack now, but there's Georgia, Belarus, and so many others that Putin is leaving alone. So why leave those alone? Are those next or just not a priority to Putin at this time?
well, Belarus is already under occupation.
Okay.
If you know that during the beginning of the war, without Belarus territory, there would be no chance for Russians to get to Kyiv. There would be no chance because Belarus is very close. It's on the north. Belarus is r run by the Lukashenko, who is, I don't want to call a puppet. He's not, but he's a close ally of Russia, and the reason for that is very simple. There are more than during the 19 in 2022, there were more than 50,000 Russian troops on the Belarus territory as a part of the military exercise before the war, and they used that territory to attack. So that's completely gone. Georgia, I would not say that Russia left Georgia alone. Georgia is a very complicated case. They were already before attacked in 2008. They were completely overtaken by Russians. Then, when Saakashvili became a president, he started to turn toward the West. But the current government of Georgia is very, very quiet about Russia. Let's call it this way. They don't want to fight them, they're just quiet. But the population of Georgia is definitely against the Russia and against supporting Ukraine. But the government is keeping that from boiling out to become another target for Putin. But I can guarantee you that if Ukraine is taken, Belarus, Moldova, and probably all the Baltic republics are next. Because his job is not just to take one piece. This is the last land empire. They want everything. They want everything which belonged to the Russian Empire, which belonged to Soviet bloc. And by the way, Alaska, according to a lot of Russians, is still part of the Russia, which was illegally taken by the United States because the revolution happened. It's not a joke. A lot of politicians, including the guy like Dugin and a lot of nationalists, are talking about that. Alaska was not sold to America; it was leased to America. And when lease expired, I mean, the revolution happened, and like America decided not to return it. That's their propaganda. What happened really? That's a question for historians, because I've heard different opinions about that. But they still think about it.
That's a new one for me. I haven't
Ah,
heard
you
that
didn't
one.
know that? Oh my God! There is a song by the very famous pro-Putin group called Lyubey, which basically translated in like, America, get Alaska back to us. It's our, get it back. That's the song which was written in 1990s. I'm not talking about like now. It was written 30, almost like 25 years ago. Very popular song among Russians.
How has this affected you seeing your homeland fighting so hard for survival, understanding what happens if they lose?
It has a huge effect on me, my family, my friends, and probably most of the Ukrainian diaspora in the United States. Think about the people you grew up with. They're in the front lines. Their children are in the front lines. Think about my cousin who has no water and electricity for the last 3 days. And this is on the fourth year. So we're doing it for the. So every time, even we work and we are Americans, I'm an American citizen. We live in America, but our hearts and our souls are there. And all of us are watching the news, and especially today, unfortunately, every person is a newsmaker right now. In Ukraine, if you want to follow the news, you're not going through websites or TV. You're going through the channels like WhatsApp channels or Viber channels or any kind of other channels with people actually sitting and typing information they see right now. And definitely another huge effect is fatigue for all of us, but not psychological fatigue of stopping fighting. No, the fatigue that we have must do so much, and energy is just draining. But what we are fighting against is people saying, oh, let's stop the war because everybody is tired. No, we're tired, but we're going to continue fighting. Okay. That's what, and all of us feel like fighters right now. All of us feel that we in America, we have to tell more about Ukraine to Americans. We have to explain what's going on. We have to, tell people here that, I feel like ambassador of Ukraine. Like every moment I'm at office or you're playing soccer or playing basketball. And yes, people are asking me questions I have to answer. And this happening for the force. Plus, definitely losses. When you see pictures of people who you knew or who are relatives and close people to we knew, already dead, when you see another building destroyed, when you see like the synagogue I attended is destroyed, the place I lived across the street is destroyed. It's mind-boggling. But nothing I can do. We went to the streets. We Ukrainians are very active. You probably don't know that, but right now in Washington, D.C., there is another called Ukraine Action Ukraine, the summit where Ukrainians and Americans who support Ukraine gather in Washington, D.C., and going through the senators and congressmen's offices and basically, help telling them that please vote for this bill. Please support our people. This is the reason why. This is what's happening. Right now, there are five or six bills in on the floor, which is related to Ukraine. One of them, for example, is about the stolen children, the kidnapped children. And by the way, one of the leaders who are helping us is Melania Trump. She's the one who is personally writing letters to Putin and personally helping to get children's out. I was in UN General Assembly at 85 at the meeting about that. It was a big there is a big coalition started by Zelen, First Lady and First Lady of Ukraine. And this coalition includes more than 80 countries and dignitaries all over the world. Another thing what is on the bill is definitely pronouncing Russia as the terrorist state and state sponsoring terrorism. That's exactly what they're doing. Not, by the way, only in Ukraine, but Ukraine is a good example. And number of crime wars, I mean, the war crimes are just staggering. And all of that we have to explain to Americans. And all of that is something are not probably on the first lines of the news ones, but it happens every day. If you saw pictures of Ukrainian POWs returning from Russia, if you compare that to the pictures of Russians returning from Ukraine, you would understand the different treatment, what happened in Ukraine of POWs and in Russia. And that's when Zelensky showed those pictures to President Trump. I don't know if you saw them, but it's staggering. It just. That's what we feel every day, every moment.
So a lot of Americans I talked to and myself were like, you know what, we'll definitely give materials, we'll definitely give support. We're not sure we want to commit American troops and American blood to this. And it's a real thing. Like we just got out of Afghanistan. We're just trying to rebuild. What does America need to do for Ukraine to help the most right now, Vlad?
I believe there are several things that American can do. And number one, for sure, is remembering and praying for Ukrainians. Seriously. People feel it. If you keep Ukraine in your mind, if you keep Ukraine in your prayers, if you keep Ukraine in your daily life, just simple things, that is very, very important. Second thing, we definitely need weapons. We definitely do. I don't think that we need American troops on the ground in Ukraine. I believe Ukrainians are brave enough to actually do that. But because of huge, need, and we cannot have factories in Ukraine that easily. All our factories are underground now because of the drones and the flying bombs. You just can't have them. So we need help in definitely delivering the weapons. And you already know, and Americans already know, that Ukrainian officers and Ukrainian fighters, they're very good at learning how to use the technology. I know that today Americans are coming to Ukraine, American military, to learn how Ukrainians are using like drones and how they're using the American equipment, because they come up with some interesting ideas which Americans never even thought about it because of the situation, current war. That's another thing. Supporting Ukraine weaponry, that's very, very important. Another thing which is extremely important for us is definitely helping civilians as much as we can. And this is what partially we do, and we'll so, but the key, and another key story is, in America, we need to learn more about Ukraine. In today's situation is, if you go to your local university and ask, I would like to learn more about Ukraine, unless you're at Harvard, which has Harvard University Research Hoover Institute, or in a couple of other places in the US, the answer is, well, we have a Russian studies department, or Eastern European and Russian studies. And you're like, are we in war? Like, Ukraine is in war with Russia. How is it possible that Ukrainians are still under the Russian studies?
Right.
And when you go in, and it's like, oh yeah, we can study Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and, oh, Ukrainian authors. Oh, unfortunately, there's no interest for that. So more Americans go to their local universities, especially, by the way, state universities, who actually use state money and federal money, to tell why there is no Ukrainian chair, why there is no Ukrainian classes. We would like to have them. We would like to know more about Ukrainian culture, because this is how you hit Russia. If you start showing Americans that Ukraine is different, that Ukraine has its own language, it has its own culture. And by the way, in 17th century, when the Ukrainians and Russians fought and the Muscovites fought together against the Poles, they needed a translator between Ukrainians and Muscovites. They did not speak the same language at all. So that is something to know. And if we start pushing that plot, plus definitely promoting any Ukrainian culture event, attending Ukrainian culture events. They're all over the place, including Boston.
Speaking of weapon systems, this one right here is the Hawk missile. And it was really interesting seeing a news article about Hawk, the system that I crewed in the Marine Corps, being used in Ukraine. And this system got multiple kills. Something that, a little factoid for you, Hawk never got a kill for the United States. It was
Wow.
a very good deterrent system. The Soviets didn't want to fly against it. But to see that missile take off the rail and kill, I think it was an aircraft that took down and two other missiles, was like awesome. Because reading the article, they went back to, what we did in the Marine Corps and the Army, learned from it, and then took it and placed it and used it. It was a very surreal moment when I saw that, and I realized these air defense is no joke, and it certainly prevented more lives from being lost. You talk about Ukrainian culture, and one of my favorite Ukrainian culture things I like to immerse in is the band Daka Braka.
Yes.
And that's when I really started. This is before all this happened, but I started learning about, Ukrainian music and how different it is from Russian music. And you have taken this one step further and kind of create your own space where people can come and learn about Ukrainian culture. Vlad, you want to tell us about that?
Absolutely. Basically, 2.5 years ago, I was asked for the local Bedford organization to talk about Ukraine.
Okay.
And then we got this idea with my wife, how about informing Americans about Ukrainian culture through the way they don't need words? What is that? Visual art.
Okay.
So we created a Ukrainian culture initiative as a 501c3 organization, which main goal is, on one side, to inform and Americans about Ukrainian culture, and on the other side, helping with the proceeds collected in America, Ukrainian artists who are working and living in Ukraine now, and who are doing a lot of good things, including art therapy for the veterans, children, who is sponsoring a lot of events for displaced people in Ukraine. And we started it 2 years ago. We did organize the first exhibition in Bedford, Massachusetts. And today I would like to announce you that on November 6th, this year on Thursday, which is next week, we are opening a new Ukrainian exhibition at Babson College. The official ceremony opening is going to be at 5 p.m. on November 6th. And the exhibition will be in the Hollister Gallery inside of Babson College until December 12th. If you have a chance, please go there, take a look at what we present. We're presenting, again, only artists who work and live in Ukraine. All of the art is for sale. You can purchase Ukrainian art, you can have it. And all the money we're collecting going back to Ukrainian artists so they can continue working and making absolutely beautiful thing. In my wife and I, we created this collection specifically for American audience. It's a very positive. It shows you the depth and kind of a full spectrum of Ukrainian art, all the way from classical oil to pastel and to paper cut, which is a very Ukrainian things to do. You will see it's beautiful. And the tapestry and many, many other things. But the most important thing is for our artists to understand and figure it out that Americans care, that they really are interested in what these artists are doing. That to me is the biggest prize. And more people come, more people see it, the better we will feel and the better we feel about what we're doing and also what our artists would feel in Ukraine, which is incredibly important. And definitely, in addition to just buying art, you can also donate towards our mission. And again, it's all tax deductible because we are officially, 501c3 for at least 2 years already. So
What's the name of the organization again?
the organization name is Ukrainian Cultural Initiative.
Okay, I
And
want.
our website is, you can find it at ukrainian-cultural-initiative.com. Take a look at, we have information about all of our artists. The exhibition will show only a sample. We have more. And another thing I would like to say, we're always looking for hosts, which means if you have a great event, doesn't matter if it's related to Ukraine or not, and you would like to beautify it with Ukrainian art, let us know. We would bring the art in correspondence to your space, to your audience. You're going to enjoy it. Your guests will enjoy it. And Ukrainian artists will get additional proceeds so they can continue to create this amazing, amazing, beautiful works.
Amazing. And I can't wait to see it. I'm looking forward to coming out Thursday on November 6th and checking it out right before Veterans Day and right when this show drops. I guess closing down, we've heard from President Zelensky a whole lot. But one thing I think that would help a lot of Americans out is hearing from Ukrainians themselves. And I know that's kind of difficult, but we just hear from President Zelensky. In the time we have left, what would you want Americans to know about what Ukrainians feel or believe about America's help and support during this time?
For us, America was always a beacon of freedom. For us, America was the country who was built by hands of the people who came here with nothing. For us, America was always the place where democracy rules, when authoritative regime receive immediate response, right? For us, America is the place where democracy not only was born in modern way, but also which promotes the democracy around the world. The prestige of America around the world based on the fact that we always standing on the right side of the history. We're standing with people who want to become free nation, with people who would like to improve their life by improving the way they live from democratical standpoint. It takes time to become democratic. It doesn't happen overnight. Ukraine is interesting situation. It's an old and new state at the same time. One of the first constitutions in the history in Europe was written by Orlik, one of the Ukrainians who had to run away from Peter the Great and ended up in France. The current constitution of Ukraine has a lot of parts of that. And when the President Zelensky or any other president was sworn to the office, one of the books they're using is that the Constitution. So, but the modern Ukraine, which was reborn in 1991, is still learning how to be a democracy, right? And America for us is a great example of what to do and how to be. This is our, one of our historical beacons, seriously. To me and to all of the Ukrainians, the American today, this war is not about just Ukraine. This war is about if the bully can win, if the instigator can use nuclear bluff, that's the phrase from Timothy Snyder, to push everybody out and to say, I'm in charge because I have nuclear weapons. That undermines the whole international legal order. And the United States was one of the guarantees of the international legal order. Hopefully, it will still be the guarantor of the international legal orders for a long time. Also, we also feel that if Russia gets its way, then every other country in the world should start getting build nuclear weapons, because how else can I defend myself against the nuclear bluff? And that is what Ukraine is thinking. And this is why when people in America, some people in America don't understand the value of this fight, we're saying, look, the God forbid something like that happened, we will have a nuclear war, because not everybody in the world has enough brain to figure it out that you can't start the war. I still remember, what was the name of that movie, American movie, when the War Games, right? When the computer played and say, like, and at the end of the world, they say there's the only way to win the war is not starting it, right? So that is, unfortunately, the war has already started, not nuclear war. But if the world united can show Russians that, you know what, you cannot make your way just using the military might. There is more, some there is something more serious and more powerful than military might. That's the power of people. Again, Timothy Snyder said the great phrase. He said, democracy looks weaker compared to the dictatorship. But if you think about it, democracy took so many punches, but democracy is still around. And most of the dictators are dead, and their dictatorship fell apart. Why? Because on the long run, democracy is much stronger. And if America, who is the beacon of democracy, will continue defending democracy, not only in America, but also around the world, then the world has a chance. Otherwise, it's going to be a lot of problems, and not only for Ukraine. And again, you have to remember, Russia will not stop in Ukraine. And for them today, I can read Russian language. I can read what they're writing in official websites. United States is their number one enemy. And they're absolutely sure that they're fighting NATO. They don't even, that's their propaganda. And they're beating NATO. Okay? So getting all of this together, we have to, but at the same time, one more thing you have to remember. Current Russian regime is not Stalin, and it's not Hitler, and it's not, I don't know, any other dictators in the world. That's the corrupt, very monetary-oriented organization, which is very similar to any kind of criminal mafia type of work. Any kind of criminal organization. Their job is to make money. They have billions of dollars stored all over the world. And by the way, the risk of losing this money can go a long way. So I hail President Trump for putting the sanctions on Rosneft and Gazprom and all of these huge money maker for Russia, for fighting against the shadow fleet of tankers around the world. This is great, because if you cut their money, then at a certain point, the people who are making money off this war, and they're making billions, they're going to sound like, whoa, 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 hold on a second. We're losing money now? Maybe we should stop. That is the only way. And Americans have to, like, remember and telling to their representatives, there are going to be elections this year, there are going to be elections next year, saying, listen, if you hit them hard in economics, in finance, if you make them a pariah around the world, if you Basically, every time there is Russian officials that are in the room, they should be treated as a mafia members, that the organized crime people, not representative of big country. So, and when that happens, a lot of other things will start happening. But yeah, definitely the United States should take better care of their allies around the world, and also work with what people call Global South. Like, by the way, the trip of President Trump to the Korea, Japan, this is great. This is, in as Ukrainians would say, this is fantastic, because we know the roles of China in this conflict. We know, and we all hope. Right now, we're hopeful for resolution, but I'm going to tell you right now that situation in Ukraine is so dire that all of us are trying to help as much as we can right now. So, hope and urgency at the same time.
Last lab, I want to thank you for coming on and sharing with us. I've learned a
Thank
whole
you.
lot tonight, and I'll have the links to the organization he heads in the Oscar Mike Rios show post. Let's go to this art exhibition and see what these Ukraine artists have created and support them that way. Vlad, thank you for sharing with me, and I look forward to learning more.
Thank you. Thank you, Travis. Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely, absolutely. This is Travis, Oscar Mike Radio. We're here all the time. And as we like to say in Oscar Mike Radio, we are mission in flight. Thank you.